Thank you so much for joining us on Super Bracket Bros. My name is Jay, your host and your personal bracketologist. And as always, sitting across from me, I am joined by your waterbending master, Elias Stokes. How you doing today, Eli?
I'm doing pretty good, although I'm a little bit worried. I was out fishing, and I ran into an iceberg in the middle of the river.
And
I don't know what to do.
So this, you just left the iceberg. You haven't, you know, cracked it open to find the prize inside yet?
No. Should I have? Does that happen regularly?
As you should know, and as everybody knows, you know, once you find an iceberg and you see an object inside, you know, you activate your magic water powers and you break it open because, you know, I mean, you could, you know, I don't know, get an avatar, you know, like one of those blue people, or you could get an avatar like the people that like bend all the elements, or, you know, any variety of exceptional prizes.
So like a gashapon.
Like a gashapon. Exactly. You nailed it. This is Super Bracket Bros. This is the podcast where we have taken 32 fictional characters, put them in a tournament against each other to see just who is the best of the best. And today, we have an exceptional matchup for you with an exceptional guest. We are joined by the second guest of the podcast, the host of Your Brain on Facts, which is a 30-minute podcast that gives you all the things that you didn't know, that you thought you knew, and things that you never knew that you never knew. She covers topics as diverse as science fiction, funerals, food origins, heroic animals, and strategic butter reserve. Some of her most recent episodes range from microorganisms that are key to your digestion to buffalo soldiers. So it is safe to say that she is much more qualified than me and Eli put together on all subjects. Welcome to the show, Moxie. How are you doing today?
Yeah, it's very flattering, but I wouldn't go overselling it. I know a non-zero amount of things about many things, but I'm not an expert in any one area in particular.
Sort of a master of none situation.
Or as they said on The Simpsons, a buffet-style intellectual.
I like it. I'll take it. And you know what? Maybe I'll be personal bracketologist and buffet intellectual. I like that right there.
Going to look great on an embossed business card.
So, Moxie, you are joining us today because you love the Last Airbender series. You know, we reached out, said you were a big fan. So, chat a little bit about, you know, how you came to find this series and what it is that really draws you into it.
I can't imagine anyone not liking The Last Airbender. It is one of the most solidly assembled TV shows, not just cartoons, but most solidly assembled TV shows of the last 10 or 20 years, from the world building, the writing, the casting, the acting, the martial arts styles that go into the different bendings, it is almost flawless. And, you know, what is not to love? Even their filler episodes are great. You know, they're also called bottle episodes, you know, where it's just the characters are in one place and it's like, okay, well, next week will be better. But no, you have things like the Ember Island Players and Tales of Ba Sing Se. And someone out there just started crying.
Those quote-unquote filler episodes are some of the series' favorites. You know, like Tales of Ba Sing Se, Ember's Island. So let's talk about Katara. So the series The Last Airbender was created primarily by Michael DiMartino and Brian Kunitzko. They're also the creators of The Legend of Korra, but collectively these two worked on series such as Family Guy, King of the Hill, and Kunitzko was the storyboard artist and art director for another Nickelodeon series, Invader Zim. None of those quite scream The Last Airbender to me.
Well, if you saw some of the character concept art, it would not seem like as much of a stretch. Momo was originally like a little robot, like a little kind of almost Robert Burbly thing, but skinny. You know, because they, I think it was DiMartino had the original characters that he ended up repurposing for The Last Airbender. And his Appa was, you ever see the original sketch for Chewbacca? Where it was like a frightening, frightening man bat. Yeah, the original Appa wasn't that bad, but it wasn't good. It wasn't good. But if you look at the original character sketches, you can see like, oh yeah, the Invader Zim guy definitely was involved here.
The Last Airbender, the series, ran from February of 2005 to July of 2008. Katara was voiced by Mae Whitman. You might also know her from Parenthood, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and most recently the NBC drama Good Girls. But Katara, in the first one, she discovers Aang in the iceberg, you know, as referenced from the opening bit, and by the end of the first season is a full-blown waterbending master.
Yeah, she really goes from sort of this like humble southern water tribe. She was basically the only waterbender in her whole like family lineage. And then, you know, over the course of the book one, as Moxie put it, you know, becomes a waterbending master from essentially, you know, the southern South Pole, which is looked down upon. So this is a really cool character arc for her.
And then moving into book two, it more where we shift the focus to finding an earthbending master. But really the big moment that we get at the very end of book two is Katara shines with her healing water. And that's when she's able to heal Aang from what is implied to be like back from the brink of death. Not implied to be, like, he was done from after Azula struck him with lightning.
Can I throw in a bonus fact on that scene?
Please do.
Okay. You may have the image of your mind of Katara holding Aang after he'd been shot through with lightning. And as somebody that got only a secondary lightning strike, let me tell you, that sucks. It is not good.
Yeah.
But it is, that image is actually a recreation of a very famous sculpture that I know I put in my notes. There we go. La Pietà by Michelangelo, which is the Virgin Mary holding Jesus after the crucifixion, which not too many years ago, a man went to the museum with a hammer, screamed, "I am Jesus Christ," and proceeded to knock pieces off of it.
Huh.
Yep. And then ensued a philosophical debate as to whether they should repair it, you know, restore it to its former glory, or leave it, because now that attack was part of its story.
Ooh.
Wow. So we have book two, and then we have the final book, book three. This is where Katara and the crew are traveling through the Fire Nation, posing as Fire Nation citizens. And one of those, like, I wouldn't quite call it a bottle episode, but we have the Painted Lady episode, which highlights Katara. And I think this really speaks to, like, just how, like, amazing this character is and how amazing Katara is just in general, as far as like what she's able to do and what she's willing to do for all peoples.
Yeah, she's a very motherly sort of character. She wants to nurture mm-hmm. everyone.
But then later on in the same book, we have her relationship with Zuko, which I think is really interesting, because as for what Zuko has done, it seems like the rest of the group sort of hops on the Zuko train pretty easily, but Katara is very much not willing to jump to his side until they go on their revenge mission, essentially.
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, everybody jumped on board pretty quickly, but mm-hmm. yeah, he's still the prince of the people that killed their mother, so you could see where she'd be a little bit bitter.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely makes sense. And that, like, they're always, you know, sort of at each other's throats, and Zuko, to gain her trust, goes as far as to join her on a revenge mission to find the captain that killed their mother. But by the time that they do, you know, he's sort of, he's there supporting her the entire time, but ends up walking her down, you know, after seeing her use bloodbending and being horrified and, you know, realizing that that's not who she is, you know. And it's just, there's just continuous development at each step through every step of this entire series, which I think is another testament to The Last Airbender.
But no, sort of piggybacking off what you guys are talking about, the reason I love Katara so much is kind of what Moxie said. She is almost this motherly character. She kind of is that the straight person of Team Avatar, that she balances out everybody else's chaotic energy, especially with like Toph and mm-hmm. Aang and Sokka just being them, you know. So
yeah.
No, Katara's always been one of my favorites, just, you know, being on the straight and narrow, but also recognizing when to have fun and when to, you know, she definitely has that. She's just the glue that holds the whole team together. I don't think they would have gone far without her.
No, I can pretty much guarantee you that much. And I mean, she's the one, like Sokka's you know, way more cautious about Aang than she is even. So like without her, you know, like there'd be no curiosity, there'd be no instigating factor to be able to like get Aang, first of all, out of the iceberg, first of all, but then also to have the gumption to join him on this journey and to be there for him in his moments of need.
Katara! Are you okay?
I'm doing fine.
Zuko told me what you did. Or what you didn't do, I guess. I'm proud of you.
I wanted to do it. I wanted to take out all my anger at him, but I couldn't. I don't know if it's because I'm too weak to do it, or if it's because I'm strong enough not to.
You did the right thing. Forgiveness is the first step you have to take to begin healing.
But I didn't forgive him. I'll never forgive him. But I am ready to forgive you.
You were right about what Katara needed. Violence wasn't the answer.
It never is.
Then I have a question for you. What are you gonna do when you face my father?
But let's move on to our other fighter here for a few minutes. We have Samus Aran from the Metroid series. And so now, I know you're an Avatar fan, Moxie, but I'm sort of curious, do you have any experience with the Metroid game series?
Not since, like, the very first one. Because in my first marriage, I was an absolute gaming widow. And it really put a bad taste in my mouth, like, ruined video games for me, because particularly like MMORPGs, every time a new one would come out, I would only see the back of my husband's head for 6 weeks because he would be playing them.
Gotcha.
And the first Monster Hunter game for the Wii, with the obnoxious high-pitched chop socky yells going every couple of seconds,
yeah.
I was going to list that in my divorce application. Just going to be like alienation of affection, Monster Hunter on the Wii. So no, I'm not the gamer that I was in the 80s.
Understandable, it sounds like. Eli, have you? I don't think so. But have you played a Metroid game by chance?
I have not. The only experience I have with Samus is from the Super Smash Brothers games.
Okay, so I'm in a pretty similar boat here. So I'm sure this has caused all sorts of uproars, but I assure you, I've brought plenty of Samus knowledge to bring to this fight, so I don't think we're going to do her wrong. But and I have plenty of Metroid knowledge. I've watched Metroid game playthroughs, I've watched Super Metroid playthroughs, and unfortunately, I've watched Metroid the Other M playthroughs. So we've got we've got all the knowledge right here. So let's talk about the creators for a second. We have Makoto Kano and Gunpei Yokoi are credited as the people who came up with Samus and the concept of the first Metroid game from 1986. Gunpei is primarily credited as the lead guy for Metroid, and he's the major player, not just Nintendo, but he was the designer for the Game Boy, and also, probably most importantly, he invented the freaking D-pad.
What?
So you have, yeah, exactly.
Kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal. What? You have Gunpei.
Why did he call it the D-pad and not the Gunpei pad or something, you know? Like,
I don't think it would have caught on.
No? All right.
But so we have, so like huge player right there. It's just in video games in general was one of the guys that came up with Samus. And then Kano on the other side, he began working for Nintendo in 74, and he was one of the original designers in Nintendo's creative department. He first started working on board games, but he would eventually become the lead designer of the Game & Watch series. His main Nintendo credits are, of course, Metroid, but also Famicom Wars and Kid Icarus. So you have Kano, the other guy, is in charge of pretty much the two, like, I wouldn't say quite, black sheep of the Nintendo family. Like, they're like Kid Icarus and Metroid are definitely not in the same category, I would say, as like Mario and Luigi and Bowser and and the gang. So it's sort of interesting that you had these not sub Nintendo but side Nintendo, you know, not A-list properties that were both came from the same mind.
Yeah.
I think fewer people would even remember Kid Icarus if he wasn't on the cartoon. And now I'm not even sure which Nintendo-based cartoon he was on. That's how important he is.
Exactly. The only reason I know him is, you guess it, Super Smash Bros. So as the artist that's actually credited with the conceiving of Samus as we know her today is Hiroji Kiyotake. Samus, going back to the character at hand here, is heavily based on another female protagonist, Ellen Ripley from the Alien movies. You can especially tell when examining their respective antagonists, you know, the Xenomorph Queen and Ridley look extremely similar, and not to mention the Metroid itself, the, you know, titular alien of the series is more or less a Xenomorph. So it's interesting to see, like, as I was watching Super Metroid, especially, like, the music was so sci-fi and it was so alien, like the movie Alien. I thought it was just fantastic.
And I also love, you know, we talk about Alien being one of the most influential horror films of all time. The extent of that influence, you know, Japan, you know, you don't think like, oh, you know, it wasn't just a Western audience who loved Alien. It was a worldwide phenomenon for this, you know, video game company to be inspired by it. So it's just, I just find that so interesting.
The plot of Alien: nobody listens to the smart lady, everybody dies, she escapes with her cat.
Exactly. Yep.
Metroid is great because, like, it just gives you this non-linear, you know, like, it's not heavily story-based, but it has great enemies, great design, and, you know, like, Super Metroid really gave birth to the genre of games known as Metroidvania, which, you know, I'm a huge Castlevania guy, so I always had one half of that puzzle, but then, like, seeing Super Metroid and how it was Castlevania in space. So, like, it was a really cool experience to learn more about this series.
Yeah, there's, like, plenty of, very popular games, like Blasphemous and Hollow Knight. Like, people still love the genre as more and more of them are being created to this very day, so.
Yeah, it definitely has spawned a huge, huge plethora of games in the same style that try to emulate it. And, you know, like, I'm not complaining. They're good games. But to quickly go down the list of sort of Samus's journey through the Metroid games, we have Metroid was released for the NES in 86. Then we have Super Metroid, which is, you know, previously mentioned, but is really hailed as probably one of the most influential, if not one of the best games of all time. And that actually came out 8 years later in 1994. And you'll notice a pattern here quickly with the releases for the Metroid games. But then we have Metroid The Other M, which came out for the Wii in 2010. And now this is critically a low point for this series, but I just bring it up because it's one of the most recent releases, actually. The only Metroid game that's released outside of The Other M was Metroid Prime Federation Force. It was a four-player co-op game for the 3DS in 2016. But The Other M, you know, has this wild story where Samus was really done wrong. She was overly dependent on a commanding officer from her past in such a weird way, and not in a way that, like, as a respect for, but more as, like, she owed him for everything that had come her way, for everything that she had accomplished, and it sort of just took away everything that made Samus, and, like, and everything that people had built up in their heads about her, because up until then she had been more or less a mute character. So it was really strange for audiences to experience that. But then we have the Prime games. We have 1 through 4. Well, we have 1 through 3 at the moment. They came out in 02, 04, and 07. And then the fourth one was announced in 2017. But in January of 2019, Nintendo announced that they had to, quote unquote, restart work on Metroid Prime 4 as the current iteration was not up to Nintendo's
standards.
That is
just crazy. I've never heard that before.
It must have been failing hard.
It had to have been, right? And I think they're, like, because of The Other M and how poorly it did, I think that has led to them being really careful with Metroid Prime 4. But yeah, for them to come out and say, we're restarting this, I mean, their shares dropped like 2.5% the following week just because of this news. You know, like Nintendo's like ultra successful, but like the fact, it's a testament to Nintendo that they came out and said, okay, we done messed it up and we're going to restart it. It's really surprising to see that kind of honesty out of a video game company.
When they put out a game we don't like, we will talk about it for the next 10 years. So
yes.
Probably better to take it back and put a little more effort into it.
A la Anthem is one that comes to mind. It does not matter what they do to that game. It is always going to be bad. Like, and we just talked about a Mass Effect character last time, so that's why BioWare is on my mind. But you have Andromeda 2, which supposedly is much better today than it was at release. But it's so hard to get that bad taste out of your mouth after you've been looking forward to it, especially Metroid Prime 4. The last one had came out in 2007, and if you released a bad one like 13 years later, yeah, that would not go over well.
I think it's a testament to Samus's place within the Nintendo pantheon. Like, we talk about the Marios, the Lynx, you know, there's the Kirbys and the Donkey Kongs. You know, the fact that Nintendo basically scrapped this whole thing because it wasn't up to their standards shows how important Metroid as a series is for the whole brand, and by extension Samus as a character. So I think that's a really sign of like Metroid is such a big deal for this, you know, their image, that they would take the extra step. And I think that's very fascinating, especially with a female led character. I just think that's really cool.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating, and I am appreciative of the fact that they did it, not being a huge Metroid fan. I understand like people frustrated with the wait, but and you bring up the last thing I wanted to talk about, Samus, is, you know, like she is like one of the few female protagonists still in video gaming. Obviously, like things have gotten better over the last 10 years. You know, namely, you're talking about, you know, The Last of Us Part 2, which features Ellie as the protagonist, which is a fantastic game, but, you know, still very underrepresentative. And like, and I hate to do this to Nintendo, but I gotta bring it up. So Metroid came out, and it was a secret. Everything in the rule book said he in it. It referred to Samus as a he. And then at the end, if you beat the game underneath a certain amount of time, then it was revealed that Samus was a woman. She appeared in her Zero suit. And like, that was the only information I ever knew about Metroid. And I was like, oh, like, that's really cool. Subverting expectations, you know, that like a primarily male gaming community has. But then I found out, I found out that if you beat it even faster, that Samus showed up in her bikini. It was so close to being like a great moment, but, and like, it's not remembered for that, so that's good. But it doesn't take away from the fact that Samus today is, you know, a well-respected female action video game protagonist, and that just doesn't exist in a lot of places. So, you know, we appreciate Metroid for that.
Yeah, but did you ever get the impression that making her female was like a last minute decision that was then added to the end of the game?
Yeah, there's definitely a part of that. Like I appreciate it, but with definitely some reservations. Like I appreciate that they ended up doing it, but it seems sort of like the bare minimum. And I imagine like if they did that today, that would not go over well whatsoever.
Well, no, nobody would be pleased. It'll be either, what's the point of having a female character? She's not going to be sexy, versus, you know, why does it have to always be sexy? Why is she fighting in a bikini? There is just,
yes,
there's going to be no way to please people.
That's a very good point. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. So I guess at the end, like, if it wouldn't be so bad if the other M hadn't sort of been a bomb and showed this, you know, stoic, strong female protagonist as overly dependent. And I mean, literally the game mechanic is that like you don't earn your upgrades. You are gradually allowed to use different abilities as your commanding officer tells you it's okay to use them.
You mean Samus, who basically destroyed planets and like helped save alien races.
not great guys, but you know what, I just hope that means that Metroid Prime 4 is going to be excellent, and I'm looking forward to it, and it'll definitely be something I grab for my Switch. So
a dream. I had been reliving the tragic moments of my recent past. Thanks to the hyper beam, which was given to me somehow by the baby, I laid Mother Brain to waste. And the explosion that followed destroyed planet Zebes, along with the remains of Mother Brain, the space pirates, and my long-standing nemesis, Ridley, and the baby.
I think that about sums it up for our character biographies. So let's get into the fight, shall we?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
How it works on Super Bracket Bros is we have random location generators. So we have 100 locations, and I am going to spin my Google number generator to see which one we get today. And we have weather and time we'll be randomizing as well, just in case it matters. But if it doesn't, then it doesn't. So
time of day or also time of month?
Time of day.
Ah.
But we do. I know why you mentioned it. One of the times I specifically state is midnight with a full moon. So that's 10 times. So we have a 10% chance for a full moon tonight.
Fingers crossed.
Let's see what we got here. Let's roll the dice. And number 54. Let's scroll down.
The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Oh my god.
The ship will detonate in T-minus 10 minutes.
Oh no.
Eli?
What? Is it my house?
Is it my house?
It's the freaky Nostromo.
Are you serious?
Well, I'm out. It was really nice seeing you guys.
What? Oh my god.
All right, how close is the nearest moon?
Okay, so
this was randomized, completely randomized.
Yeah, there's no way. And for context here, and if you haven't listened to our Brooke versus Cyborg episode, we had Halloween Town, and Halloween Town features Jack Skellington, and Brooke is based off of Jack Skellington. And now we're going to the Nostromo, where we have Samus, and Samus is based on Ellen Ripley. And I know all pop culture is connected, but this is sort of this is a little ridiculous, right? Like.
I don't know. I mean, I'm noticing a pattern here, and you were the guy that assigned the locations both times.
I know, and this is why I almost thought, like, as soon as I saw it, I was like, you know what? Maybe just this one time I should fudge it so people don't think I'm fudging it. So, like, honest to God. Okay, so I first of all, I want to say I don't think Katara stands no chance. I'm going to say that there are water pipes everywhere in the Nostromo. I think that's reasonable, right?
Yeah, because for atmosphere, there's always flickering lights and dripping water.
Plus, additionally, we've seen Katara carry like jugs of water on her person.
Yeah,
so.
She always has her water skin.
100%. So I think like that's there. So let's chat about this fight.
Wait, what's the time and weather? What's the time and weather? Is it raining or snowing? So,
this is why I said if it matters. So there's no weather. I'm not BSing like a heat wave on a Nostromo. So let's chat about these fighters here. Oh geez. So we have our magical Super Bracket Bros portals open up. We pull them out of their respective universes and into the alien universe to face each other. I mean, Samus isn't really very chatty, so they probably don't have much of an opening interaction. But Katara is probably at least a little thrown by the orange and red spacesuit, and also the spaceship.
Because Katara, I think, would want to negotiate. She'd want to talk this out.
I 100% agree.
I don't want her to. That's really the pussy way to handle the situation. But
yeah,
that is what Katara would want to do. She would want to talk it out first. So let's say they're already enemies and they're in different parts of the ship. I'm going to say that their individual skill sets and talents notwithstanding, it's probably going to come down to who gets the drop on the other one.
Ooh.
If Samus gets the drop on Katara, it's over. If Katara gets the drop on Samus, then we actually have a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to talk about how the metal of her suit could or could not interfere with waterbending, because we know that Katara is willing to bloodbend under certain circumstances. And since we're in outer space, I am going to declare that there is a moon nearby.
Oh my God. Well, not even just the bloodbending. We're not bringing up ice bending. If she has access to her, I mean, I've seen her almost use like those water pouches as almost sickles, you know, striking things.
Yeah, I mean, she's daggers of ice.
And we should wonder if, you know, say there's a water pipe that Katara can burst, you know, just sending a swash of water at Samus and then freezing it.
Yeah. See, here's the thing with, like, Samus isn't exactly, there isn't a stealth suit that I ever saw when reviewing all the Metroid games. Like, the best that she can do is roll up into a ball and traverse the Nostromo via the vents. And I don't know about you, but if I heard, like, if I heard a giant metal suit condensed into a ball, that's got to be, I would say, several hundred pounds, the power suit itself with Samus inside of it, like clunking through the vents of the Nostromo, that I don't think she's going to necessarily be able to sneak up on Katara.
Because if Katara doesn't know what Samus looks like, she could just hang out as the ball when she knows Katara is nearby. Mm. And then when Katara steps close enough to her, just pop up, bang.
Oh my God, that's such
like... Wait, which side am I arguing for?
That's such like an elementary school tactic of Samus just hiding in a corner.
It's almost camouflage. Since Katara will be in an unfamiliar environment, she won't know that this round thing does not belong in this environment. But mostly when I was talking about getting the drop, I just meant coming around a blind corner.
Mm.
Not going through the air ducts.
Yeah, I thought of Die Hard style, just Samus John McClaning. Well, I guess one thing I would like to bring up is Samus, although Moxie, you are right, she has like a laser gun. She is, however, an experienced... a very experienced bounty hunter, whereas Katara, she's not the most militaristic mind. Maybe that could come into handy for Samus's side.
Well, yeah, see, what I'm thinking is Samus is, like, Katara has taken down a lot of different benders, and we talked about this a lot with Toph and Aang last season, how the biggest opponents anybody from Avatar has taken down has been another bender, and, like, the most fearsome one was definitely Fire Lord Ozai, that Aang took down. Like, that was the only moment of like pure massive destruction we ever saw. But like, when you put them in a tournament like this, Katara now has to go up against Samus, and Samus has taken down Ridley dozens of times. She has taken on monsters that are 15, 20 times her own size. So like, Samus, I think for sure has strength and durability on Katara. I think that's obvious just from the power suit. But like, just to what degree? I mean, if she gets frozen, I think she almost certainly breaks out. But I think like, Samus has a lot of experience on her sides dealing with a bigger variety of threats than Katara does.
True. She's more of the trained soldier. Though Katara hasn't just been engaged in one-on-one combat, she has been able to take out or at least escape from groups of people. Because she can manifest, you know, she can control entire walls of water.
Mm-hmm.
This is true. And like, I could see her using water to push and to pull Samus to where she wants Samus to be and sort of and maneuver her that way. But I just don't see it doing a lot of damage to Samus. That's the thing. And the suit is, I would say, if we're going to make another, let's bring in a fourth pop culture reference here, is more like Infinity War Iron Man rather than the first Iron Man suit. You know, it's sort of like a nanoparticle that appears on her rather than being something that's put together by like in pieces.
Now, are we assuming that Samus's body has the same percentage of water as an actual human body?
So the thing about Samus is that she is imbued partially with the DNA of her like adopted alien species, the Chozos. But I don't think that has anything to do with Samus's water content.
Well, then why even bring it up?
Because I had it in my notes and I didn't mention it earlier, so okay. I figured...
A fair point. A fair point indeed. Okay, because here's the thought I had, and this is going a little off canon, but I just bounced this off you guys. So we know about bloodbending. We got all that. We know that waterbenders can bend anything with water in it. Plants, mud. The human brain is largely water.
Ooh.
It's a nice blend of water and fat. Couldn't a waterbender just cause the water in someone else's brain to just go somewhere else in their body?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
I mean, yes. I 100%.
That's why I didn't get into the good schools.
No, I 100% I do believe that. It's just I think in order for Katara to do any sort of blood or brain bending... that she has to go like way on the opposite side of like her moral code, and I think she has to be fatally injured in order to resort to bloodbending. And once she's fatally injured, then I believe Samus has won the fight. Yeah, well, okay, here's one big thing I do want to throw in Katara's favor. The beams, the laser cannons that Samus has, she has two main modes. She has her standard, which is just an energy beam. But one of the biggest weapons throughout the series that is important to her character, because the Metroids are weak to it, is an ice beam.
Ooh.
And I'm thinking, like, if she chooses to use an ice beam against Katara, I'm pretty sure Katara could stop that beam and push it back into her.
If she can recognize it before it hits her.
I think if she's able to dodge and sense the ice in the beam, I think she could be able to gain that recognition and then use it again against Samus next time. But it would take a pretty incredible leap of reactions, though.
I can kind of picture it, though, that Samus takes a shot, Katara dodges, but she looks, you know, she's laying on the ground, and she looks up over her shoulder and she sees this patch of ice on the corridor wall and realizes, oh, there's ice in there. And what does she do with it at that point? Like, just make the gun explode into shards of frigid shrapnel?
One thing I do want to bring up is I think a big point in Katara's favor is sort of area control. We talk about this with Avatar characters. That's sort of their sphere. Mm. That's something they specialize in. And being in these cramped corridors, which I'm assuming water vents flowing through, and we've seen waterbenders, you know, able to bend things out of pipes to break them. If they're in a corridor, what? Katara just shoots a plume of water, and like Samus has nowhere to go.
Oh yeah, she could flood the entire corridor and freeze the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And if she gets enough layers of ice on Samus, I could see that being a KO, but it has to be very significant. So we've talked about a lot of different things here, but I think we're it's going to be tough. Well, let's get into decisions, and then we'll talk about why, and then we'll go from there. So Eli, do you have an out of 10?
I'm going to go Samus 6 out of 10 times. And my reason being is because of that first shot mentality that Moxie brought up. Samus, you know, she is a seasoned bounty hunter. She's, you know, defeated so many space pirates. Fighting is in her DNA. She knows that suit in and out and how to use every single weapon. But, you know, Katara is a force of nature, which brings up its whole different rule set. But the thing is that Samus has that keen instinct. She knows when to fire the first shot. She knows how to incapacitate an enemy before they have a chance to react. And if we're coming down to brass tacks in this fight, I think that is going to get Samus over that 5-win level that we always talk about. Katara, I think, stays in because of just the overwhelming power she has with the freezing, the water bending. I do give it to her to get access to the water pipes and start like flooding, you know, the interiors and just freezing and using her jugs of water as like ice weapons, essentially, and maybe pulls out some brain bending. Maybe. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's just that killer instinct of Samus. She is just a bounty hunter. And I think in a one-on-one fight, that's where she excels at versus Katara. You know, if she was on a journey, you know, adventure, I want her right in my squad, you know, right next to me, helping me out. But if I want somebody eliminated, I'm probably going to go with the bounty hunter. So I'm going to go Samus.
Well summarized.
6 out of 10 times.
And Moxie, do you have an out of 10 for either of these characters?
Professional bounty hunter, emotional 15-year-old girl. Professional bounty hunter, emotional 15-year-old girl. Since they are so divergent in their abilities and other characteristics, and it's going to come down, I think, to a lot of happenstance, I'm going to go 50-50.
So it comes down to me, and we're back to the out of 10, which I have to decide. Okay. Out of 10, I'm going to go 6 out of 10 times for Samus as well. I think Samus, for all the reasons Eli said, I think the experience as a bounty hunter and as, you know, someone that's traveled the solar system and the galaxy to be able to defeat enemies that Katara, like, you know, like, we don't ever see it. Like, she doesn't decide to stay and fight the serpent at Serpent's Pass, right? Like, if she had a feat like that underneath her belt, you know, I might consider otherwise. But I think Samus, like, just the one-shot ability overcomes all the different abilities that Katara has and all the different ways that Katara can win, which there's plenty of. But I think just the one-shot of Samus will end up catching Katara at some point. And even if it's just a shoulder shot or a leg shot, like, it's going to be enough to incapacitate her to then have a significant enough advantage to take down the fight. And I do see Katara winning 4 out of 10 times, you know, via, you know, ice walls and ice daggers and all these other things. But I am going to give it to Samus.
A fair decision.
Hear ye, hear ye.
And with that is the decision. We have Samus moving on as the 4 seed in the East. And that's actually the last matchup of the Eastern bracket. She is going to be going up against the winner of last week's matchup. She's going to be facing the winner of All Might versus Garrus Vakarian. So make sure to tune in a couple months once we start up the second round to be able to see Samus in action again. I will hand it over to you, Moxie. Now, just let everybody know a little bit about your show and your book.
Yes, I have one of those now. For your weekly half hour of things you never knew, after you have finished listening to the entire back catalog of the Super Bracket Bros, use that same app to look for Your Brain on Facts. If for some reason you want to get my nerdy knowledge without listening to my mellifluous golden radio voice, you can get the Your Brain on Facts book. Please contact your local bookseller from a safe distance because they need your love now more than ever. You can also order online from bookshop.org, which is like a central clearinghouse for indie bookstores. And there's always Amazon if need be.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely head to a local bookstore to find Your Brain on Facts. I've taken a look at the preview of the book and I've listened to a bunch of her episodes and they're all super informative and very entertaining. And she has some great guest spots. She has great guest spots as well from a lot of other great podcast hosts that really bring a lot of, I mean, it's Your Brain on Facts. It's facts directly into your brain. And I know I really appreciate getting to listen to your show every week that it comes out. If you want to find Super Bracket Bros, we are on Instagram and Facebook at Super Bracket Bros. If you have a halftime suggestion, we do listener suggested matchups. Make sure to either direct message us on either of those socials or email us at superbracketbros@gmail.com. But with that signifies the end of the show. Do you have anything else for the people, Eli?
In space, you can hear me say no.
No. Thank you so much for listening to Super Bracket Bros. My name is Jay, and on behalf of my co-host Eli and our very special guest Moxie, remember, no true hero is a one-trick pony.